Welcome to another episode of the Westminster Confession of Funk on the Fight, Laugh, Feast Network. This is a podcast about storytelling, fatherhood, music, poetry, literature, the creative process, theology, and the perils of trying to live the good life. I am Jason Farley, author, teacher, pastor, and publisher at Jovial Press, and I missed a few weeks. I have been wrapping up a school year here and have not been able to get to the microphone, and it's really good to be back. I want to look today at poetry as a way of exploring different ideas, gaining different perspectives, trying to see from the perspective of another person in a way that helps us bring wisdom into our life and understand how to live well in the world that God made. And I want to do that by looking at the way different poets and authors discuss the relationship of the individual to society. We all know that there is something broken in the world. There's something broken about the way people interact with one another, and something broken about the way that people interact with society as a whole. And we live in a day and in an age when we expect our politicians to just fix everything. And that's our go-to. Whether we're on the right, whether we're on the left, we just assume that if there's a problem, then we should look at the politics and look at the power structures in the world and say, that's where the issue is, and we need to fix it either by getting the politicians out of the way, or by getting the politicians more involved, or changing the politicians, or changing the laws. And that's just the only way we ever look at this particular problem. But if we look through history at different poets and the way they explore this idea, we can actually see that you can look at it, the problem, from different perspectives and gain a fuller understanding of the problem and see different ideas about solutions. Because there is a break, it's objective. There's war in the world, people are lonely, the society doesn't function the way that it seems like it could or that it seems like it ought to. And I want to read a section out of a poem by Kenneth Koch that's called On Beauty. And he just talks about this existential experience that people have of not really fitting into the world or fitting into society. He says, it may be that seeing birds in a more natural, everyday way would make them seem more beautiful to me. I do not know. Since this has not happened, birds are something I was told were beautiful when I was a child. Flowers also were, and especially roses. I am still slightly uncomfortable with roses. The moon and the stars were also on my parents' and teachers' lists of what was beautiful. It has been hard for me to love them, stars and moon, I mean. But I have, despite this early training, which may be injurious to beauty in some cases, in others not. In raising your child, you should share your feeling with him of what is beautiful, but do not expect a child to respond to it that way. He or she is likely to respond more like a poet or an artist, wanting to do something with it, to run through it, or eat it, or tear it apart. It is in later life, perhaps, precisely the suppression of these feelings, or some of these feelings, that result in our feeling of beauty, which we are merely to contemplate. Contemplation seemed to Aristotle the superior mode. To others, it may seem an unnatural mode of life. You can hear all throughout this poem, it's a beautiful poem by Kenneth Koch, but you can hear all throughout it that he just doesn't feel like he fits in the world. He doesn't feel like he fits with society. And a lot of people read that and they connect with it. They say, yeah, I feel that way too. I feel that existential separation between myself and other people. I feel like society is not functioning the way that it should. It's objective. We look around and we see that there's a problem. And in fact, the problem has been being discussed by poets since the ancient world. You look all the way back to Euripides, who wrote the Bacchae, and he tells an entire story, an entire drama about the society is falling apart. And the reason is because the gods, the fates, are just simply against mankind, that the problem goes all the way up to the heavens. That's why things are falling apart here in the world. Now, of course, the Greeks believed that mankind was made by the gods because the gods were tired of making them their food grow. They were tired of having to farm, and so they created mankind to be their slaves. And so every time the Greeks brought a sacrifice to the gods, that sacrifice showed up on the table up on Mount Olympus. And so long as you kept bringing sacrifices, the gods would ignore you, leave you alone. You didn't want the gods showing up in the ancient world. If they came close, something had gone wrong, and Zeus was probably going to get one of your daughters or your wives pregnant. So you didn't want the gods coming anywhere near. But the reason that mankind was always in trouble, and that society was always on the verge of breaking out into chaos and falling apart, is because of where they came from. They came from the gods, and the gods didn't create them because they loved them. They created them because they needed slaves, and now the gods were just against them. Fate was against them. And so the Bacchae is this entire story about what's the problem? Well, the gods are the problem. But Homer, also a Greek, had a little bit of a different view. In the Odyssey, you have the Cyclops, Polyphemus, and from the earliest interpretations, the Cyclops is seen as a commentary on what it would be like for mankind to have no society. The Cyclops, whose name is Polyphemus, he's one of the Cyclopes, he lives in a cave all by himself. And he only has one eye. All the Cyclopses, that's where they get their name, they have one eye. And if you only have one eye, you have no depth perception. And they were pictured as what it would be like to have no fellowship, to be without society, without a people, without a common and communal story, common and communal poetry. A man that has no community is a man without perspective. He's a one-eyed man. Two eyes give us depth perception. They give us spatial wisdom. Community, in communication, gives us perspective. We can see the world not only through our own eyes, but we can see the world through the eyes of another, through the eyes of our neighbor. When we are in fellowship with a community, we gain wisdom. We gain depth perception on reality. So Homer, some of our oldest literature outside of the scriptures, is already commenting on the need for society, and that when society breaks down, the individual loses himself in a certain sense, loses his ability to live well as an individual in the world, that we need society. Now, the later different poets come along and they say, actually, society destroys the individual. You have the Romantics come along and they say, no, society is destructive for the individual. And Sigmund Freud, who's one of the invisible actors in the intellectual world right now, we don't talk about him much, but he is really, really influential. He said that society comes along and keeps us from doing the things we really want to do, and that creates our ego, that society suppresses our real desires and it creates our ego, that there's these true desires and society keeps us from doing them, and that's bad. Well, that's not the only way. We tend to think that way, that society is bad for the individual. Well, Homer said, actually, society is good for the individual. And another author, Joseph Conrad, who's more of a modern author, makes the same sort of argument in his book, Heart of Darkness. It's the story about a sailor named Marlowe who sails into the heart of the Congo. And this is during the Victorian age when the British Empire is spread far and wide. And he thinks he's going to spread the light of civilization into the Congo and that's what the British Empire is doing. But when he gets out to the Congo, what he discovers is that the British Empire is actually terribly mistreating anyone and everyone they get a hold on. And in fact, the further away from society the English get, or the Europeans get, the further away from society they get, the more the desires of their heart become the thing that guides and directs them, and their hearts are full of darkness. And that it doesn't matter where you come from, it doesn't matter what continent you were raised on, what civilization you're from, that you have a heart that is full of dark desires. And society keeps you from going where your heart wants you to go. So these desires will destroy the world around you, that every individual human being is a black hole of desires, and that they will devour the entire world to try and fill the black hole of our desires if given the opportunity. But society puts pressure on the darkness of our hearts, and therefore society is good for us. Without society, we would be even worse than we are, but society holds us back, holds us in an important way. It forces us to put a mask on the darkness of our desires. And we tend to think of wearing a mask over what we really want and who we really are as a bad thing. Well, Joseph Conrad, who went out and saw the things that people do when they get out into they get out too far away from society, he said, no, no, no. Society forces us to put a mask on the darkness of our desires. That's a good thing. Society keeps us from doing terrible things. And that's a good function that society has on us. This is why when we hang around people that we respect and that we care about their opinions, we act better. Right. And Joseph Conrad points out in his book that that's actually a good thing. That's something that we should embrace. That's something that we should want, is for the people around us to cause us to act better than we would if they weren't around. And you know, Heart of Darkness is a great, great book. One of the great novels, I think, of all time. And it shows up all over the place. You know, at the beginning of Peter Jackson's King Kong, The shipmate is there reading Heart of Darkness, the one that has the wisdom to share with the main character. He's sitting reading Heart of Darkness because they're about to go onto this island and discover that there are, without restraints, that all of the people are terrible, are going to be terrible people. And, you know, Peter Jackson had just made the most successful movie of all time in The Lord of the Rings. And his very next movie, he makes all of the bad guys Hollywood producers and directors, and he lets them go out and get away from society, and they become terrible people, or they reveal that they have always been terrible people. And, of course, they're reading Heart of Darkness at the beginning of the story. So it's a really, really wonderfully written book, a beautifully poetically written book, with a really important thing to say to us, something to remind us of, is actually society is a really helpful thing, because when you look deep down within what you really want to do, we've got dark hearts, right? So we've got Homer saying that without society, we actually are fools, right? We can't learn the wisdom and any depth perception on reality. You've got Joseph Conrad coming along and saying, and society is really a help because the individual can't be trusted because of their hearts are so full of darkness. Shakespeare has something really interesting to add to the conversation as well. In Hamlet, which is, in my opinion, the greatest drama ever written, Hamlet begins, we learn that what's the problem? Well, there's something rotten in the state of Denmark, right? That the society at its core is diseased. And it's described as a shoulder out of joint, or an arm out of joint. And that Hamlet's job is to deal with the illness and to reset the shoulder that has been pulled out of joint by the rottenness that's going on in the state of Denmark. And as the story goes on, you learn that, well, what's the rottenness? Well, there's war on the horizon, there's a usurping king on the throne, and he's in the queen's bed as well, and he has killed his brother, who was the king, and a righteous man is set on the path to restore it. And all Hamlet has to do is bring righteous legal vengeance into the scenario, right? He just needs to cut out the disease with what is his right to do, which is kill the murderer of his father. And at the time, it would have been his right to do that because he would have been the blood avenger. And so he legally was supposed to go and kill this man. And he had the opportunity. Shakespeare gives Hamlet the perfect opportunity to take legal vengeance. And instead, the darkness of his heart, he lets his own dark desire for revenge, rather than a simple righteous legal vengeance, win out. And society ends up being torn apart by the private hatred of the individual head of state. We learn that young Hamlet is the rightful heir to the throne. He learns that he's the rightful heir to the throne, and he is a representative of the people, and because of his own private hatred winning out, because of his own unrighteousness, the entire state of Denmark falls apart. Right? So the relationship that Shakespeare lets us know is that there is a real relationship between the private righteousness or wickedness of the leaders and the health of society. And that's Shakespeare's argument in Hamlet, is that the private righteousness or the private wickedness of the leaders has an effect on the entire society. So an entire society can be pulled apart and reorganized, which is what happens to Denmark at the end of the play. The whole society is pulled apart and reorganized because the leader's private dark hatred wins out over righteous legal vengeance. So that there really is something to the fact that politicians have something important to do. And when you're a public person, your private life has an effect on public society. Right? So you've got these different poets looking at the same problem and saying, well, here are different issues, different perspectives on this problem. There's a great poem that I want to read from Theodore Rutke, which is spelled R-O-E-T-H-K-E, but it's pronounced Rutke, I think. I can never figure out how to pronounce it. But in his cycle of poems called Four for Sir John Davies, the third poem in the cycle is called The Wraith. And it's talking about how the individual, apart from society, is like a wraith, is like a ghost, when we're not connected to our society properly, we become too spiritual, we become ghostly, we become disconnected from the world around us, from society around us. But he presents a possible solution to the problem of our disconnection of the individual from society. He says, or he writes, "Incomprehensible gaiety and dread attended what we did. Behind, before, lay all the lonely pastures of the dead. The spirit and the flesh cried out for more. We two together, on a darkening day, took arms against our own obscurity. Did each become the other in that play? She laughed me out, and then she laughed me in. In the deep middle of ourselves we lay when glory failed. We danced upon a pin. The valley rocked beneath the granite hill. Our souls looked forth, and the great day stood still. There was a body, and it cast a spell. God, pity those but wanton to the knees. The flesh can make the spirit visible. We woke to find the moonlight on our toes. In the rich weather of a dappled wood, we played with dark and light as children should. What shape leapt forward at the sensual cry? Sea beast or bird flung toward the ravaged shore? Did space shake off an angel with a sigh? We rose to meet the moon and saw no more. It was and was not she, a shape alone, impaled on light and whirling slowly down." Now he goes on to explain this more, but he says that individual human connection, like ghosts linking arms, will eventually lead to a restoration of society. How do we move back into societies? Well, we look at the person next to us. where we can't fix the whole world at once, but we can look at the person next to us, help the people around us return to themselves by that individual human connection, by in pairs connecting with one another, as neighbors connecting with one another, with a husband and a wife connecting with one another, with parents and children and brothers and sisters connecting with one another. We can be like ghosts linking arms, and eventually that might lead to a restoration of society. We can end up with large societies if ghosts link arms with one another. Otherwise, we're just like floating ghosts, disconnected. We're disconnected from ourselves, disconnected from one another, disconnected from the world that we're created to live in. And he says, what can we do? Well, we can look at the person next to us. We can dive into that relationship right there and see if a small society might break out, a society with just you and me. And you've got another great poet, Alexander Pope. He was a neoclassical poet in the 1700s. He is not popular right now because he writes everything in rhyming couplets. And the only poet that writes anything in rhyming couplets in our day is Dr. Seuss. And so a lot of people, when they pick him up, they feel like, well, I'm reading children's poetry. Well, it used to be that rhyming couplets was a high form of poetry, and Dr. Seuss changed the way we react to that form of poetry. And so he's unpopular in our day. It's unfortunate. He is one of the earliest Christians trying to attempt to write a worldview of what it is to be a Christian. He was one of the great Christian humanists and wrote a lot about the way that Christ restores us to ourselves, restores us to who we are intended to be. And that Christian humanism that says in Jesus was fully and perfectly human, or he was fully and perfectly God, fully and perfectly human, and in Christ, we're restored to God, but we're also restored to humanity. We're restored to ourselves, restored to who we were intended to be. If you want to know what a perfect human is like, you look at Jesus, right? If you want to know who God is, you look at Jesus. He is the perfect revelation of God, but Jesus is also the perfect revelation of humanity. And when we want to know who what humanity is supposed to be like, we look at Jesus. In the same sort of way, when we are in Christ, our humanity begins to be restored, and that over time, our humanity becomes more human, right? That Jesus was the perfect human, and we become more human in him. And Alexander Pope was one of the great Christian humanists writing about what that meant, and he's got a great extended poem in multiple epistles called An Essay on Man. And the last poem in there is called On Happiness, and it's about what does it mean for us to be happy as individuals. And he says, remember, and this is right in the middle, about line 35, he says, remember, man, the universal cause acts not by partial, but by general laws, and makes what happiness we justly call submit not in the good of one, but all. There's not a blessing individuals find, but some way leans and hearkens to the kind. No bandit fierce, no tyrant mad with pride, no caverned hermit rests self-satisfied. Who most to shun or hate mankind pretend, seek an admirer, and would fix a friend. He says that if we want to fix society, we have to become who we as individuals were intended to be. And that when we want wrong things, when we don't want virtuous things, when we want vice, when we want sin, when we want evil, it actually hurts not only ourselves, not only our relationship with God, but it actually hurts the community. But when we want what's lovely, want what's true, want what's good, then it's a blessing to those around us. When we become the person God intended us to be, when we live according to our nature, when we live according to who God made us to be, it actually affects the society around us. It builds the society around us up, that our neighbors are blessed by us being who God made us to be, by us seeking to live virtuous lives in Christ, our neighbors are blessed and built up around us. So it's not that we have to fear society, that somehow society is going to make us worse. Instead, we focus on loving God and focus on wanting what's right and being who God made us to be, and society will be built up around us. And this is similar to what Augustine talks about, that when we serve God, when we follow God, it's not that we do more and more things that we don't want to do because we get better and better at controlling ourselves, and we can do what's right even though we don't want to, but that actually our desires are changed and transformed. That the more we serve and follow God, the more we want to serve and follow God, that our desires at a fundamental level are changed and transformed. And that's what Alexander Pope is talking about, and he says that is the best way to be to have a positive impact on society around us. Now, Walker Percy's a wonderful novelist mostly, although he wrote some essays as well. He has a wonderful book, Love in the Ruins, and it's a novel about the way that society is crumbling, and the reason is because we objectify people. We turn the people around us into objects, and they are either useful for us or not useful for us, but we treat them like objects. And it's a pretty intense novel because it's set in what's called a love clinic, where they're doing experiments, sexual experiments, and it's destroying people because the people are being treated like objects that you can scientifically study. And the point is that it doesn't work that way. Human beings aren't objects. You can't turn them into objects and expect that to not have an effect on us. And the biggest problem in society is that we have ceased to treat other people as people made in the image of God, and they have become objects of use, that we use the people around us. That people, including ourselves, we treat them the way you would treat a robot, or you would treat a tool or something, and that what can we get out of it is the only question that we ask. And what's interesting is Walker Percy, his solution to the entire objectification of people and of ourselves is that God's ultimate act of de-objectification is the cross of Christ and the sacraments. That's the only way out of this particular mess, is that society is crumbling because we're treating each other and ourselves as objects, that we spend more time watching ourselves live our lives than actually living our lives. We think of ourselves objectively rather than entering into our lives. We sit up in the balcony of our lives and we watch our lives rather than live our lives. He says, but you can't do that if you go to church and you partake in the sacraments. It is the ultimate de-objectification because we are being fed by God. Right, we are being spoken to by God in the sermon. We are eating and drinking with God. We are learning that we are subjects of God's love. We are not simply objects. And for Percy, the sacraments are incredibly powerful as defining acts. They tell us who we are. Our baptism and the Lord's Supper give us our nature. They tell us this is who you are. And Walker Percy, he would look at the recent conference on women's ministry at the Southern Baptist Convention and see that there's You know, there's no mention of motherhood as a ministry that women do, something that women do for the Lord. And he would say, well, of course they wouldn't mention that, right? They're Baptists. They don't baptize the fruit of a woman's womb. And when they don't do that, they are declaring with an ultimate megaphone that the womb is useless. The words that they say might say something different, but the sacraments are God's way of marking the true meaning of his image. And if you don't baptize the babies, it's because the babies don't have it. And therefore, rational Bible teaching is ministry, right? Because you're teaching the people that can respond sacramentally, that can respond to the sacraments. Birthing, loving, protecting, feeding non-rational organic units can't be ministry. Right? It can't be if you're not going to baptize those babies. Being in worship and being talked to, touched, or fed by the preached word and by participation in the sacraments, that is what restores us to community, according to Percy. That's how he would put it. And Calvin says something similar it's a great little book of letters from John Calvin. People would write to him for ecclesiastical advice, and there's a little book that collected them together called Calvin's Ecclesiastical Advice. And in there, John Calvin says, the Eucharist is the communion of the body and blood of the Lord, and God's people should understand the necessity of their frequent participation in the flesh and blood of the Lord, as well as its great benefits, which are received from this participation and mastication, or chewing. John Calvin says, how do you receive the name of the Lord, or receive the grace of the Lord that tells you who you are? He says, well, you chew it. You drink it. That's how you learn who you are, that the sacraments have a way of defining who we actually truly are, and that's the only way back into community, according to Walker Percy, is when we come together and we worship together and we take the body and the blood of the Lord together in the sacraments, and when we witness the baptism of one another, and we remember our own baptism, and we say, oh God, I'm carrying God's name around. I'm carrying the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit around with me. I mean, that's what it means to not take the name of the Lord in vain. I mean, we shouldn't curse and use swear words either, but what that commandment actually means is when we take the name of the Lord upon us, when we are Christians, right? We are Christ's people. When the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit is put on us in baptism, we are not to take the name of the Lord in vain. We're not supposed to carry it around in an empty way. It's the thou shalt not be hypocrites commandment. And that hypocrisy is just the refusal to receive from God what our nature is. And it's only when we live according to our natures that we can be a part of any true community. We can be a blessing to the society around us. Another poem by Theodore Rutke, it's called Child on Top of a Greenhouse. And it reads this way: the wind billowing out the seat of my breeches, my feet crackling splinters of glass and dried putty, the half-grown chrysanthemums staring up like accusers, up through the streaked glass, flashing with sunlight, a few white clouds all rushing eastward, a line of elms plunging and tossing like horses, and everyone, everyone pointing up and shouting. It's this great poem as a little boy, he's climbing up onto the top of a greenhouse, and people begin to gather around. And first, they're a little concerned, got a kid up on top of a greenhouse. But then he points them up to the wind as it blows, and the trees as they're waving their hands up toward the sky, and they all look eastward, and all of the people end up coming together and joining in this act of worship that the trees are involved in, and they also raise their hands and they point up and they shout eastward with the wind and with the trees, right? The community is brought together when their eyes are all lifted up together, right? And that's really the only way to restore society at all, is to learn to come together and worship together. There's no restoration of society that does not begin as a restoration of worship. Only when we become who God created us to be, worshipers, will society be put back together. And the reality is, we're all going to worship something. That's not an option. We like to call ourselves Homo sapiens, thinking man, but I don't think that's a very good definition. There's a much better definition given in a book by Alexander Schmemann that calls us worshiping man, right? Instead of being Homo sapien, thinking man, we really need to know that what we really are is worshiping man. That is who we are, what we were created for. And there's no way to say, well, we'll just put society back together, we'll get some new laws in place, we'll get this or that changed, and society will start to function properly again. Society is broken all the way down to the core because we are broken all the way down to the core as individuals and as a society. And when we're brought back together in worship before the Lord, society begins to become possible again. That's the only place that society can really be actually restored. And it's not a secret that society is broken. All the poets agree on that. What is the secret that was hidden from us from the foundation of the world is that we're made in the image of a triune God. That society is a real, true possibility because we are made in the image of a God who is one and three. That we can be put back together into a society because we are made in the image of a God who is eternally a society of love. He has from all time been the Father, Son, and the Spirit. And so we can be restored to society, but we become like what we worship. So when we gather together and we worship the Lord together, then we become a society again. Society is put back together. And it's so helpful to see all these different poets looking at the problem from so many different perspectives so that we're not like Polyphemus, we're not like the Cyclops in Homer's day in Homer's poem that has no society and therefore has no depth perception on reality. It's so helpful to see all the different poets and the different writers and the different authors look at this, and we get a good perspective where we look at it from a lot of different directions. But that is what the church is supposed to function like. People with different experiences come together and look at problems together, see from one another's perspective because we're in fellowship with one another and we can listen and hear and speak, and we come to really know and understand everything from lots of different perspectives. That's the kind of society that the church can be. So thanks so much for joining me for another episode of the Westminster Confession of Funk. If you're looking for more of the funk, you can find my blog hosted by the Fight Laugh Feast Network. You can find my books at Amazon.com, and you can visit Jovial Press for more. Thanks for joining me, and keep it funky, people.